Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this week's Left Ahead podcast. This is Mike Ball of Left Ahead in Marion, Massachusetts, and we have Ryan Adams of Left Ahead and Ryan's Take at ryanstake.net. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a wonderful day. It's been a series of wonderful days. This is great. So today we are expecting a candidate for the U.S. Senate from Massachusetts, Marissa DeFranco, and we'll talk to her about how she expects to become known, and I think we'll draw on Ryan's expertise as a professional political organizer from time to time and see, because she is well known in the immigration community, in the legal community, and immigration rights areas. But a lot of people don't know her otherwise. She has not held public office. And we'll ask her how it is that she expects to get known and raise money and, you know, all those predictable things, I think. She is a strong, strong believer in the traditional American dream of, you know, becoming an American and contributing to society. So those seem like salable values to me.
Absolutely.
So she will, of course, be going for Scott Brown's seat, which used to be Ted Kennedy's seat. I don't know. He has a quite a reputation as a charming guy who has a lot of contacts and a lot of money.
I mean, right now, too, I think we have a really interesting race within the Democratic Party for the primary going on, because it's really just a bunch of people that are essentially the Scott Browns or of the last election, or the Val Patricks of 2006, which is just a whole bunch of people that don't have that name recognition yet. And are therefore really going to get a chance to make something of this, and you don't really know who's going to win this. You can't really predict it. And it's just going to depend so much on who can get out there and shake most hands and deliver a message that the most people will remember and like. So I mean, it's gonna be a really unique and I think dynamic election, and I'm actually kind of excited to see what happens with it, because, like I said, this is really gonna be a very different election than what we've seen in any sort of recent year that I can think of. I can't think of an election like this where we haven't had some sort of a big dominant name in there, whether that dominant name went in to win, which last time that we had a big primary in the Senate election, Martha Coakley was that big name and did go on to win the primary, if not the general. When you could look at Val Patrick's 06 race and say the big name and going into that race did not win, which was our former attorney general. So, I mean, it's certainly going to be an interesting race, and I think that really we should be excited about it, and I think that honestly this offers our best opportunity to put out the sort of fresh face candidate out there that would have a chance to actually beat Scott Brown. This doesn't have sort of any baggage or any reason not to vote for that person.
I believe Marissa DeFranco has joined us, is that correct?
Oh, yes, hello. Sorry, I didn't want to
Excellent.
Jump in there.
Thank you. Good. Yeah, this is Mike Ball, and Ryan Adams is also on, so thank you for joining us.
Ryan. Hi.
Hi.
So we gave a brief introduction and, did say, the obvious things is a lot of people don't know you outside the legal and immigration rights communities, and, we are curious, of course, how you're going to present yourself, how you're going to raise money, and how you expect to capture that seat. So, I mean, the most obvious things are there. So I see that your, certainly your literature and website stresses the path to becoming an American, you know, your own family history and the long tradition here in this of immigrants becoming the productive members of society. Yet I see that you have a lot more in your platform. So we'd like to get right in and see what you want to stress and how you expect to get people's attention.
Absolutely. Where is Julie? Jim, like, want me to jump right in then?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, so, you know, so as you saw, I can hit the immigration in a minute, but I think first and foremost that everybody's concerned about is the economy and jobs, and it just doesn't seem like anybody's serious about actual job creation. And, you know, people talk about jobs, bills, or how are we going to get this economy moving, but no one talks specifics. So I always like to talk in specifics. So I have two very concrete ideas that will be going up on my site soon, but I've talked about it before on other shows, and I've been traveling across the state meeting with people all over. And number one is when we're talking about reform and financial reform, we are giving all of our money, our taxpayer money, away to banks. And Congress is just giving it for free and writing absolutely no terms into that giveaway. And which is disturbing because Congress has, as you know, many lawyers in both houses, but they don't seem to know simple contract law. For example, when Tim Geithner, I mean, it was revealed at the beginning of the month, gave $30 billion to Goldman Sachs at 0.01% interest, which basically, let's just call it what it is, you know, 0% interest. That was it. It was a free giveaway. Well, under my idea, when we're talking about getting capital moving, and if we're going to give money to the banks, we're going to put terms on that. We're going to say, you can't, we're not going to bail you out unless you have to give 20% or 30%, whatever the number we negotiate, to small interest loans, to small, low interest loans to small businesses. We're going to cap that interest rate at 4%. Because let's face it, when banks are getting money for free, 4% is still a very nice markup for them, and they're going to do fine. And if the banks don't like it, then we can talk to banks who will like it, like community banks, and keeping money locally. Can you imagine if you were, I'm a small business, and a 4% or even a 3% interest rate, again, that's not set in stone. We negotiate that. People would actually start taking out those loans and hire people, you know, that would be an investment in their small business, and they would start to hire people because small business, as we know, is the engine of the economy, and we should be laser-focused on getting them the capital they need to do what they do best, which is create jobs. The other part of that money is going to be, we're going to require you to help people refinance or help people buy their first home who have good credit ratings, and you're, again, we're going to cap that interest at a certain percentage because those people have earned a low interest loan. And again, if you want our taxpayer dollars, you're going to come to our terms. If you don't, we'll work with banks who will.
Yeah, we've been appalled here at, well, small businesses, many of them say that they can't get enough cash, although, you know, some of them have, you know, have to go back and be more specific in expanding to get it now because it's tight for everybody. But the big businesses have not been hiring. They've been sitting on their money.
Right.
And it's disturbing me. I think it's like everybody ought to share in, you know, getting America back on track, which means putting it out there and hiring people so there's money in their pocket so they can buy things and you can make things and sell it to them. So that's one of our favorite horses here.
Right.
So how is it that you would change in the Senate? Why should people vote for you as opposed to other people in the Democratic primary or vote for the incumbent Scott Brown?
For a bunch of reasons, but I'll highlight a couple, because I am the Democrat in the race, progressive, a proud progressive. I don't shy away from my ideals that stands up for Democratic ideals. I will actually say the word unions and be proud of my support for unions. My grandfather was a union worker at GE for 40 years, and Democrats need to be proud of the fact and stand up and shout from the rooftops that unions is what helped to build the middle class in this country, and that we should never abandon our laborers and our workers who are the ones who also are our biggest supporters. So because we believe in their ideals and they believe in the ideals of the Democratic Party. And I am the one who stands strong on women's rights. I have a proven track record of over a decade of working. I don't just say that I support women's rights, but, you know, I put it on my website, and as a checkbox, I've actually walked the walk and talked the talk. I'm a commissioner on the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women. And since I've been on that commission, we've made equal pay in the form of comparable work our top priority. And that bill was dead for 12 years until we worked that bill, and we did get it out of committee for the first time ever. And with my work on Violence Against Women Task Force, with my work with immigrant women and U.S. citizen women, and my background in the Battered Women's Program, and my work on a most recent victory that I'm very proud of and very happy about, with a case for a client from Uganda who was fleeing torture and persecution, who was gay. And I know everybody, your listeners know what they do to people there under the current regime. And I won that case with almost 400 hours of pro bono work. So that is the type of advocacy and dedication and commitment. No matter what else is on my plate, if I commit to something, I see it through to the end, no matter what. I am the candidate that stands again strong on those Democratic Party principles of a government of, by, and for the people, and not capitulating to the corporations. Because when Democrats run for the middle, and when they corporatize the party, and when they consistently argue on the turf of the Republicans, we lose. We saw it happen in the 2010 elections. We did not pay attention to the base. And I am the candidate who has that backbone, that does not back down or try to triangulate somewhere into a position where we're going to make the corporations happy and still try to stand by our ideals. You have to be strong on your democratic principles. And I like to take a page out of Shirley Chisholm's book when she called herself unbought and unbossed. And so she's one of my heroes, and that's how I see myself.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, she should have been president.
World. I also, and also on the small business side, I am an immigration attorney. I'm self-employed. I've run my small business for 14 years, so I know what it's like to start from absolutely nothing with no connections and put in the hard work and put in the toil and represent small businesses and helping them build their businesses with U.S. citizens and immigrant workers and knowing how to get capital. And I cross the board from firms that work in nanotechnology, restaurants with chefs, and hospitals with nurses and doctors, and social workers and preschool teachers. So I have a very deep and broad experience of working with those businesses. But as I also always say, I fight the federal government for a living. So I have 14 years of experience of knowing how the federal government works, how the laws are good and bad, and how to change it. So I've been on those front lines, but I've also served in a liaison capacity with the Department of Homeland Security, and so as one of the biggest agencies in the federal government, so I know how it works. When you look at what a senator does, which is legislate, advocate, and work on foreign treaties, I have the advocacy down. I'll match my record, unparalleled record, with anybody out there. With legislation, again, I have a deep and a long experience with how federal legislation works, so I know I can write better laws than the way the Senate is currently writing them. And with foreign treaties, I work with foreign embassies around the world to help my clients, get what they need and come here and prosper and live the American dream, as you were saying. So that's me in a package and why I think I'm the best candidate.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I think one of the real opportunities of having you in this race is your immigration background, and immigration to me has been one of those crucial issues and so many different facets of our country that just has been left ignored or one of those issues that a lot of politicians have been afraid to address.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, what would you find to be sort of a workable solution that would help the most people and at least move forward with this issue and be something that you think you could get through? I mean, would it be something like the Kennedy-McCain bill to was a near miss, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Or is it something different?
Well, there's a lot of different things. That bill I was not thoroughly pleased about, as were not a lot of immigration advocates, because it had a lot of bad pieces of it. First and foremost, a guest worker program, which I adamantly opposed, because we tried that already. It was the Bracero program. And you end up with a second class of citizens. You just bring them here for a couple of years. Or, what you know, Bush's plan was you come for 2 years, you leave the country for a year. You come back for two, you leave, and you get a maximum of 6 years. It's a horrible idea because you undercut the U.S. workforce. People, once they're here for 2 years, you know what happens. People marry, people buy homes, or they become part of the fabric of our society. So it's a little insane to have a guest worker program to just use someone for their labor and exploit their labor and then say, bye, thanks a lot, and we're going to send you home. We did that once already in this country with the Chinese. They built the Transcontinental Railroad, and then we passed the Chinese Exclusion Act from 1882 to 1941, the only race we wrote into the law of actively deporting, excluding, and then actively deporting. And that was a disgrace, and we're not going to do that again. The pieces that are good, the immigration reform that needs to happen, is that we need to recognize that we haven't written comprehensive immigration law since 1965, and the only thing that's really happened since then is tinkering with enforcement enhancement and, Reagan's amnesty, which was a real amnesty in 1986. But other than that, we haven't touched it. So it's very dated, and that's why it's broken. And a lot of times I don't just talk to people who agree with me. I make it a point of talking to people. And as you can imagine, being an immigration attorney for 14 years, I run into a lot of hostility. And what I always say, I mean, there's a certain percentage, whether it's 10% of people, we're not going to change their minds because they're just xenophobic and racist, and that's, they're not going to change. But I firmly feel that people that disagree with us on this issue at the outset, it's simply a matter of not knowing the details, because what independents consistently say to me is, or even Democrats that oppose immigration, and they are out there, or they're too, like Ryan, you said, they're too afraid to tackle the issue. So this is the quote I always get. We don't mind immigrants, but we just don't understand why they don't come here legally. And so I tell them, because they always, the common phrase is, why don't they just apply for a work permit and get in line? You know, my answer to them is always, because there's no such thing as a work permit and there is no line. There's no line for people who don't have bachelor's degrees, who are essential workers, and there's no mechanism in our system for that. And so when they start, it's a 10 or 15 or 20-minute conversation, but when we have a back and forth and they understand, they see that, you know, Congress has not had the political will to tackle this problem and really revamp the system so we can have employer and employee match. We can have mechanisms in place that go after employers who are exploiting immigrant labor and to the detriment of the immigrants and the U.S. workforce. And when people start to see that, they say, yeah, we would like to have a system where it works like that. And also with the other thing is family unity that no one ever talks about, is because everybody always focuses on the business side of immigration. But people don't realize that even as a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, you're going to wait 5, 6, 7, 10 years in the instance of your brother or sister to bring somebody here, and you're going to be financially responsible for them. You're going to sign a 10-year contract with the federal government, and you're still going to wait that many years because families get short shrift in the immigration world, and the numbers have never been worked out to have any semblance of relation to the needs of U.S. citizens and permanent residents. So that's one area that needs to be looked at as well. But when we're talking about immigration reform, and what was missing in the whole debate the last two times, was immigration reform in conjunction with trade policy reform. And I make it a point of always talking about this because, again, no one's talking about it. When Congress passed NAFTA, we all know how horrible it was for American manufacturing jobs, right? But no one ever talks about how bad it was for Mexico, because here's what happened. the U.S. and Canada were allowed to continue to subsidize, and it wasn't family farms. Money's going to agribusiness. We all know that. No, family farms aren't getting the benefit of that government money. So we're subsidizing giant agribusiness, and what did the corn industry do? They flooded the market in Mexico with cheap corn. Mexican farmers weren't being subsidized by the Mexican government, so they could not compete at all. What happened? 2 million Mexican corn farmers were thrown out of work, and then at the very same time, we had an uptick in undocumented immigration in the early 90s come through. So those two things are absolutely related, and if we're going to have trade policy, you know, everyone says we have to have fair trade policy. I agree, and we have to have the environmental mechanisms in place as well. But we need to decide if we're going to have trading partners. Are they really going to be partners? And are we looking at not only building up our economy, but also making sure that that economy of our trading partner is growing as well? Because if we don't, the very immigration reform, you can have the best reform in the world, but it's going to mean nothing because if you don't have good trade policy, because those people are going to leave their countries and they're going to come here.
It's interesting that, you know, nationwide, we have a reputation in Massachusetts as being these incredible pinkos here, and I may very well be, but the state per se isn't, and we saw in the flood for the incumbent that there's a fair amount of social conservatism out there. How is it can raise enough money and as well as getting the voters behind you to unseat the short-term incumbent?
Well, that's what I've been building for the last few months. I've been going all over the state, Western Mass, South Shore, North Shore. I live in the North Shore, to the cities and towns, and building that grassroots that will, you know, instead of that will fund my campaign both in terms of dollars and energy. And what I said when the Boston Globe asked me about this, you know, the National Party trying to get a big name candidate in here, and my response was, it's great if you have a big name, and so they think it's great. So, let me rephrase that. You get a big name, they can raise the $2,500 or the $5,000 per couple, and then you just tick off your list, and you get all this giant amounts of money, but you didn't raise the, you raised the money from a few amount of people instead of raising small donations from a vast, large amount of people. How are you growing the grassroots at $2,500 a pop with donors? You're not. And that's what happened in the 2010 elections. And we've seen it over and over again with money. Steve Paluta spent the most in the special primary. He came in last. And so I think when you look at the statistics, the one thing that beats money is power. And the National Party ignores at their peril the ability to build that grassroots with small dollar donations, because it's not just about the money, it's about the turnout of the voters in the end. And they have precedent for this, and I was a history major, so I really take umbrage when we don't remember our own history, especially as a party. Paul Wellstone was outspent 7-1 by an entrenched Republican incumbent, not just a short-term incumbent, as you say, with our senator, and he beat him. He's outspent 7-1. So he's not the only one. There's stories like that across the country of how a true Democrat who stands strong on the principles and works with the base and getting new ideas and rejuvenating the party can win.
So that certainly worked for our Governor Paul Patrick.
I'm sorry. What's that?
I was just saying, you know, the grassroots, netroots, social media thing also worked for our current governor, Deval Patrick, and I was curious whether you were building on for your grassroots, if you were building on the social media and the plain folk and the students and so forth.
Absolutely right. Again, Governor Patrick is a perfect example, and I have everything going on with social media and Twitter and Facebook and FaceTime, obviously, across the state. And I do have my strategy. Of course, it's a little bit proprietary because, you know, we have to develop that. And it's not a secret, though, that my natural supporters that are people that have been involved in women's rights, who know me and know my record, people who have been involved in the immigrant community – I've been a leader in the Massachusetts Bar Association. So I have a lot of deep roots and broad roots in various areas where people are excited to join my campaign and get involved at this level and build, you know, build the momentum as it keeps going. Because I always, with anything I've ever done, whether it's my business practice or casework, you know, individual, one by one, is that you build things steadily. You don't just charge in there and do something, you know, big flash in the pan and then forget the undergirding, the foundation. You have to have a good foundation, and then that's a slog. And sometimes, you know, the national party is not interested in the process of building that foundation that we need, because once you do that, it's not just for my race, it's for the state as a whole. Because once you do that and you keep building that foundation, it can be, and you get people involved and invested, those people will be true activists, and they will tell other people, and then it multiplies exponentially.
Now, the Democratic primary is, of course, only like step one of this race, and then the big challenge is going to be beating Senator Brown. How would you describe the job that he's done thus far in office, and what would your sort of messaging strategy be once you're out of there? Would you sort of take the fight to him, what would be your strategy?
Well, the job I think he's done is, what job has he done? I haven't seen any bills that he's sponsored that's created any jobs, that has alleviated the workload of the middle class or the laborers who are, well, productivity is through the roof and corporations keep getting rewarded handsomely, but everybody else is left behind. And sort of this survival of the richest mentality that Scott Brown and his supporters adhere to. So, and I don't give him, you know, people talk about, well, he has a terrible record on LGBT rights, and people say, well, he voted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I don't give him credit for that, because he did not vote to end the debate. And so it's a little disingenuous to say, I'm not gonna vote to end the debate. But if you get enough votes, then I'll vote for that bill. That's the kind of weasel move that he engages in, because he's never once, as the party chair John Walsh has said plenty of times, has never voted with the Democrats when that vote actually mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the record that I would go after, and that is the record, you know, where he said he was going to be an independent voice, but he votes almost 90% of the time with the Republican Party. I'm one of those lawyers who actually can do math. And so I don't know about how Scott Brown is at math, but that's pretty bad. You can't be independent when you're 90% of the time with the party.
So I take it you're looking forward to some debates.
Oh, yes, I am. So I will throw down my debate skills against Scott Brown any day of the week. I do litigation, actual courtroom work, and like I said, I've gone up against the Immigration and Customs Enforcement trial attorneys, and the type of advocacy my track record is, walking into one of my recent cases and the trial attorney was against my position, they didn't see the theory of my case, and we walked out of there a couple hours later and they did a complete 180, so I used the skills that I have to convince them that I was right on the issue. So I would look very much forward to that debate with him.
So you won't rely upon a expensive barn coat and fancy pair of boots?
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm not sure what a barn coat. I think the barn coat was something that Catalog invented. And it's, you know, maybe if it had been some shabby thing you've been wearing for 20 years. I've got a couple jackets like that. I could one-up them on the – I have a jean jacket that's about 20 years old. Maybe I could debate him in that jacket. But we're talking about – flash and no substance, and I have the substance.
Okay, well, we're coming down to the end of the show, and I appreciate your time and wish you good fortune here, because this should be an exciting race here. I just there are a lot of us in the progressive end who still think of that as Ted Kennedy's seat and don't think that he's the right person to be sitting in it. So we'll be watching this race with great interest.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me on, Mike and Ryan.
Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Okay. Good. We'll check back with you in a couple months then.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and we're over time, but we should let people. I don't know what we're going to be. Two of us are going to be talking about something next week, I guess, at 2:30 on Tuesday, but I'm not sure yet. If you check with Left Ahead at leftahead.com, we'll give you a topic before next Tuesday. How about that?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right.
Until then.
Goodbye.